this week's 51%, a deaf woman expresses her love of music and misconceptions.
I don't wish they would experience it in the same way, but I wish they would just respect what I feel. I feel it, I'm sure of it.
We'll hear from filmmaker, writer, and artist Miranda July about her first novel, and then a snippet about Muppet feminism. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Jazz to hip-hop, Louisa Petker finds herself wrapped up in music. But she hears the music differently than someone who is not deaf. Marcia Adair reports for DW from Hamburg, Germany.
Louisa Petker is a 28-year-old student from Hamburg. She loves music and goes to more concerts than most of her friends. Jazz, classical, hip-hop, it doesn't matter. If there's music playing, she's there. There's one thing, though, that makes her a bit different to the usual 20-something music lover.
I was diagnosed deaf when I was 3, or hard of hearing.
Music has always been important to Louisa.
I always have this memory of a song called Mannish Boy by Muddy Waters. I recognize it everywhere I go because we used to listen to it every Sunday morning. I used to say to my mom, please can we listen to it again, just one more time, one time. I felt that I could listen to him and feel the pain in his voice because it's very rich and I could relate to the lyrics.
That's Louisa as voiced by her friend Stella von Randau. Even though Louisa is fluent in German and English, she prefers not to use her voice in public.
I wouldn't say I experience music only physically, because I do hear some things. I just don't know if what I hear is the same as what you hear. It's not only like bam, bam, bam. There's a melody, and sometimes I imagine it in colors. Like when there's a high sound, it's golden or yellow. A deeper sound is blue or indigo. Sometimes you have a very high sound, like a triangle or something, and I can hear that. I couldn't tell you the exact melody, but I think it would be safe to say that I could play it in my head.
Because she wasn't born deaf, Louisa's parents sent her to a hearing school and communicated with audible speech instead of sign language. As she got older and her hearing loss became more profound, Louisa found it increasingly difficult to determine her identity. Was she a speaking person that couldn't hear as well as her peers? A deaf person that couldn't sign very well? Or some combination of the two?
I had a very tough time a few years ago and I felt totally lost. The only thing that helped was to listen to jazz. It helped me calm down. To just sit there and listen. Nobody's asking me to do anything, to communicate, to behave in the way a hearing person would. I would sit there for 2 hours sometimes. It kept me sane, I would say.
Louisa considered getting a cochlear implant, a popular device that uses electricity to stimulate the auditory nerve. In the end, she decided against it. One of the factors was how the implant processes music.
I didn't want to get an implant because I didn't want to have the surgery. And I knew that hearing with an implant is a whole lot different to hearing with a hearing aid or hearing naturally.
Here's a simulation of how music sounds with the implant, created by the University of California at Irvine. See if you can guess the tune. And now here's the same sample as a hearing person might perceive it. Deaf people who like music often like electronica and techno because of the loud volume, the repetition, and the low frequency. All these things make it easier to hear the sound with the body. Louisa loves jazz.
John Coltrane. My friend says it's too emotional to listen to that all the time, but I say no. Maybe it's because I hear it differently. I have a picture in my head of him playing the saxophone with his long fingers, and the notes are just rushing out of the saxophone and into the world. I like that image.
What'd you do last night?
Hip-hop is also a favorite.
The new moon rode high in the crown of the metropolis, shining like who on top of this? People were sussling, arguing and bustling. Gangsters are god thumb, hardcore hustling.
There's a song called Respiration by Mos Def and Talib Kweli that starts with a woman speaking Spanish. It says, the city is listening, the city is breathing, just listen. I like the idea of a song about the city you live in and feel content and happy in, but at the same time you feel like you don't belong and you need to leave.
Louisa learned to play the piano as a child, and a few years ago collaborated with friends to write hip-hop lyrics. These days, she's interested in sign language poetry. But so far, she writes just for herself.
A friend of mine is always pushing me to sign what I write, but I'm like, not yet. People who start to learn to sign later, like me, I just started 5 years ago, need a lot of time to be fluent enough to do a poem. I think if I want to perform a poem like this, I need to feel deaf. Really, really deaf.
Hip-hop, jazz, Mozart. For Louisa, music is everywhere.
Sometimes we're out in a cafe or a bar, and I feel the vibrations in a wooden chair or the sofa, and I say, there's music playing, isn't there? And they say, how do you know? It's so quiet. And I say, come on, it's vibrating all up my legs. When I tell hearing people I feel music, they're saying, oh, you just feel it, but it's not the same. I don't wish they would experience it in the same way, but I wish they would just respect what I feel. I feel it, I'm sure of it. Of course it's different, but for me it's enough.
This is Marcia Adair for Deutsche Welle in Hamburg.
Miranda July is a filmmaker, artist, and writer. Her collection of stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You, won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. She wrote, directed, and starred in the feature films The Future and Me and You and Everyone We Know. And now she has penned her first novel, The First Bad Man. And she spoke about it with 51%'s Joe Donahue.
Did you assume that eventually you would write a novel? Did you always know that?
Kind of. I mean, I think if you dream of being a writer, and I did because both my parents were writers and they ran a publishing company, so I really kind of grew up with that idea of adulthood. Then yeah, a novel is like the great challenge.
So talk about the challenges in pulling it off, in writing it and having it be what you wanted it to be.
It's funny, it wasn't as crazily hard as I thought, and I think that is only because I had made two feature films before. And all the people who are, you know, telling you how hard it's gonna be, they actually haven't done that thing, which is actually harder. So I think the challenges of it were, it's a different process than short story writing. I had written my short story collection pretty quickly, like each one was sort of an act of passion. I didn't do a ton of revisions. And writing a novel, you just sit in that chair day after day, year after year, and it's not good writing, most of it. You know, it's not that kind of unsustainable but sort of genius moment, you know, when you're filled with feeling. And that's actually what's most interesting about it, is that you're going through all different chapters in your own life as you're writing it. And I started this when I was pregnant and finished it when my son was two. So it was an intense time in my own life for sure.
Do you think that so many reviewers would say this, and maybe I'm only bringing it up because I read it in a review, but do you think it would be said that this work is cinematic if you were not, if you didn't have the background of film?
Well, it's funny because I always feel like such an uncinematic filmmaker. I always feel like a very literary filmmaker.
Right.
So I'm kind of pleased that I'm now being cinematic, although maybe in the wrong medium. And there were some moments where readers of early drafts pointed out that I was doing some kind of filmy things, like cutting between scenes in a way you would do with film, but is really too confusing in a novel. They'd be like, whoa, 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 where are we? And, you know, I thought it was like a genius cut. And you really don't cut in novels that way that often without sort of drawing attention to yourself. So I guess there were a few things that I had to get out of my system.
The First Bad Man is the story of Cheryl. So tell us a little bit about Cheryl. And what I'm fascinated by is the choice of, is obviously telling the story in the first person, which allows you to be so psychological about this character.
Right. It's so intimate. And her inner world is kind of an unreliable, kind of nutty world. And a lot of the book actually hinges on mistakes she makes, you know, things that she misses that no one else would. It's so enjoyable to have a character who's not worldly or even that daring, doing really pretty radical, daring things. I mean, in the realm of like sex and violence, because we're so used to the people who are sexual and violent are also kind of like beautiful and daring. And she's like the opposite of all those things. She's very uptight. She lives alone. She's pear-shaped. She's in her mid-40s, and in a way, it's her blindness and naivete that kind of allows her to move into some wild situations without really seeing them that way.
And it is a novel that addresses motherhood, and as you said, you were pregnant when you started writing the novel, so that obviously has some impact on its creation.
Yeah, I will say I came up with the whole idea for the book well before I got pregnant, and I had that baby character in there, and I think I just figured, well, I'm 37. I think I was 37 at the time, and I know it takes a few years to write a book, so I imagine I'll, if things go the way I want them to, I imagine I'll have something in my head about babies during these years that I'm writing this, but I didn't exactly know what that was. And in fact, when I handed in my first draft, when I was like 8 months pregnant, I put a little note to my editor that said, I'm not even going to bother fleshing out this baby stuff when in a mere matter of weeks I'll know what the hell I'm talking about. You know, like, why fake it? So, yeah, I wouldn't say the story wasn't really changed by my real experience, but certainly there's a beating heart there that wouldn't have been there if I'd been making it all up.
You know, I read this novel a few weeks ago, and I loved it. And I love your stories, and I love your work, and it was so much fun to read. Meanwhile, I go to my independent bookstore, and I'm looking, and I see your book there, and it has one of those shelf talkers from the staff, and they're writing
right
about it. And it's from a female staff member who's writing about what a wonderful novel it is. And at the very end, it says, "No man will ever understand or enjoy this book as much as I did."
She's so wrong, right?
I felt that way, and I was going to ask you this question. So immediately, I took out my pad and my phone, and I wrote down the question that I was going to ask you, which is, I mean, do you feel that men can fully understand your work?
I definitely write it for everyone. Like if I thought that, I mean, in a kind of ridiculous way. I mean, clearly there's some people are not only not going to read it, but if they did, they would hate it. But I have a very sort of empathic, like I'm being comforted by the idea of this diverse future audience that includes men, that includes people of all ages, and I do keep that in mind. In fact, when I first shared the novel with readers, I purposely went to strangers, friends of friends that my friends helped me find, and I had kind of a laundry list of people, including like someone who's not my fan, who's kind of skeptical. I want a stranger like that. I want a man. A man was on that list. And I think I was trying to make sure that there was nothing in there that was doing something alienating that I didn't intend, because you can't always see what you're doing. You know, it all feels right to me. And I know it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but I just wanted to make sure everything was intentional that might be uncomfortable. And that was hugely useful at that stage.
One of the things that I loved in the book, in the novel, is this sort of cadre of misfits. These wonderful characters who come together, and I believe even in one of the reviews that I read, it likened them to a cast in a Vonnegut novel. And I thought that was very fitting, because there are these wonderful characters that come out, and so that yes, we are seeing this story through Cheryl's eyes, but there are these wonderful characters around her. And I'm curious as to, in your creation of that supporting cast, of what you wanted that to be, so that it would not in any way dilute Cheryl's story.
Right. Well, you know, the story I set out to tell really was just Cheryl and Clee. So all those other characters kind of came of their own accord, almost. I remember having a moment, you know, I had this therapist character, and she's just a therapist. I don't know. I was trying it out. It seemed useful to have Cheryl talk to a therapist. And I remember coming out of my writing room and saying to my husband, "You'll never guess what just happened." And I was just like shocked that the therapist had just kind of revealed her own bizarre and submissive relationship with another doctor. And I mean, I was just like laughing with shock as I was writing that. I was like, this can't be. Like, and in truth, just as you said, I thought, yes, maybe it can't be. Maybe that is too much. And so it had to kind of, it took years for that to gather enough weight that it actually became supportive to Cheryl's story and not a distraction.
Was there ever a concern that by doing something or by telling an aspect of Cheryl's thought process that you would make her less sympathetic?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of fine-tuning of her character. I mean, there were things down to the final drafts that I was adjusting, and it's I think in the end it becomes a matter of degrees, like, you know, like a degree less here, you know, a degree more sympathetic here, and those things really make a difference. So it's not about like changing who she is, it's just like the wording. I remember, this is hopefully won't turn anyone off because that's not the point of this interview, but there's a point where she imagines, this only happens in her head, someone reaching into a toilet and grabbing a bowel movement.
Right.
And I changed that to that she imagines that they reach in with a slotted spoon.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of change I'm talking about. Like, it's just like one step less repulsive, even though no one ever does that. It's just a thought she'd have. But to even like sanitize her thoughts a little bit, you know.
It would seem to me that they would almost become a mantra of something that you would put on a post-it note over your computer that would say one step less repulsive.
Yeah. It was that. And often it was not so much less repulsive as just one step more pride, you know,
yeah.
Like give her something to be good at and you can get away with a lot of weirdness.
Because you ultimately want us, as I think we do, as I did, you want us to like her. You want us to
right.
at least empathize and enjoy the company of this woman.
Right. Yeah. And to care at the end that she has transformed in her way. Yeah.
So this is at the point where I have to ask the obligatory question of when it comes to what is next, and because we were talking about the cinematic nature of this novel, do you return to cinema? Do you want to do that? Do you want this always to be a part of the arsenal?
Yeah, it is pretty much just like that. Like I don't want to lose it, you know? And if it takes so long to do, and it's already been, you know, a handful of years since my last movie, and so there's part of me that's thinking, like, okay, gotta get started, because in movie, if you just think of me as a filmmaker, like, I'm really not prolific at all, you know? And it's kind of a low-level pressure, but honestly, whatever sort of pushes you forward, I tend to just rotate, so I don't have the slightest idea what my next novel will be, and thank God I don't really need to think about that until this movie is well underway.
Would you ever make a film of the book?
I mean, I thought about it so much when I was writing it. It just seemed like the best movie to me. I was like, God, I wish I needed to write a movie right now. Because it's just, you know, it has suspense and great characters to cast, great women characters. And now that I'm done, it seems like, well, I'm definitely not going to direct it. And I kind of doubt that the, like, one person that I would love to have direct it would. So, no. I guess no.
That was Miranda July, whose debut novel is The First Bad Man. She spoke with 51%'s Joe Donahue. A prestigious award from the Brooklyn Museum in New York honors women who have made outstanding contributions in their fields. This year's surprise honoree is Miss Piggy. The Muppets character joins a distinguished list of recipients of the Sackler Center First Awards, including former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The Daily Beast recently called Miss Piggy the Gloria Steinem of the Muppet world. She will be interviewed at the June 4th ceremony by the feminist herself. The museum's Elizabeth Sackler Center for Feminist Art was founded by its namesake. Sackler says Miss Piggy embodies spirit, determination, and grit, and has taught millions important lessons about overcoming obstacles. Miss Piggy, known for her French affectation, declared, quote, "Moi is thrilled." By the way, Kermit the Frog will also attend.
W-O-P-I-G. That's all.
And that's our SHOW for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1347.